This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Bill Fick Ford, the WCRA, and Pendleton Whiskey. Born in the iconic American Western town of Pendleton, Oregon, and taking its name from one of the most revered rodeos in the world, my absolute favorite rodeo, known for the grass, the Pendleton Roundup. Pendleton Whiskey is a modern celebration of a century-old tradition. Pendleton Whiskey is barrel-aged in American oak and cut with Glacier Fred spring water from Oregon's Mount Hood. For an uncommonly smooth, rich taste, and complex flavor, the Pendleton Whiskey brand honors a heritage that inspires us to live boldly, never lose sight of the values we believe in, and taste the moment, wherever we may be. The legacy of the American cowboy is forged in every single bottle. A taste of true Western tradition is always worth raising a glass to. Discover more at PendletonWhiskey.com. Oh, and Pendleton Whiskey is the official whiskey of Pro Rodeo and of the PBR. Pendleton Blended Canadian Whiskey, 40% alcohol by volume, Pendleton Distilleries, Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Please drink responsibly. Bill Fick Ford, the number one Super Duty dealer in the entire country, is still taking care of their customers. It's hard to get trucks right now, but there's some perks when you're the number one Super Duty dealer in the country. You still got trucks. Go to BillFickFordHuntsville.com to get the no bull discounts that no one else is giving during this crazy time that we're living in. Bill Fick Ford is still the place to go. In fact, if you ask me, it's the only place to get a new Super Duty dealer today. Bill Fick Ford. Who wants to be rodeo's next millionaire? It's time. That time again through the WCRA, you can win $1 million by nominating your rides or runs and earning points through the WCRA. Through the Triple Crown of Rodeo, the WCRA will award $1 million in cash prizes to any one athlete or collection of athletes who wins first place in any three consecutive WCRA major rodeos. $1 million is completely up for grabs. The days of 47 cowboy games and rodeo will be the second stop of the 2021 Triple Crown of Rodeo Series. The event will pay out over $560,000 and will be held July 20th through the 24th in Salt Lake City. Get this, there will be zero entry fees, people. You heard me correctly. No entry fees. The only way to qualify for the Triple Crown of Rodeo event is by nominating your rides and runs with the WCRA. Use promo code GAGE10 for 10% off your next nomination. Again, that promo code is GAGE10 for 10% off your next nomination. To learn more, just visit WCRARodeo.com and learn how you can earn a spot at the Days of 47 Rodeo and possibly be rodeo's next millionaire. What?
This is The Gauge with host Chance Conradude.
Are you freaking serious? It's Conrado. Hello. Welcome back for part two of the 13-hour Secrets of Benghazi podcast with Mark Geist and, of course, myself, who was not there. He's way cooler than me. We talk about quite a few things in the second half of the podcast, as well as PTS, not PTSD. Check it out. You know, you really get deep into a story, but then you really have to go to the bathroom and you just start squirming more and more, and then it distracts you.
It does.
I think it's required to take a bathroom break. All right, so we kind of just started getting into kind of some of the political talk, or you were just kind of ushering us towards that. Because that's one of the key kind of pieces that you didn't mention really yet in your story, because you guys were trying to get support that whole time, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we had asked for support. I know Tonto had asked, you know, for anything that they could get, you know, and why they didn't send it. It's complicated but simple. You know, it's one is depending on where aircraft are and assets are from two things. First off is the country was basically controlled by Department of State.
Right.
And they're the senior agency because there was no DOD assets in country that were there for DOD purposes. If that makes any sense. So yeah. for DOD to send help in, they have to get permission or be asked by the Secretary of State or her people.
Mm-hmm.
And no one asked them. So they didn't send anything. And there was stuff, I mean, you know, and that was one of the frustrating things for us was that they said there was nothing available, nothing that could have got there in time. You know, and when they say, yeah, there's nothing that could have got there in time, that means you know how when it was going to end, right? No, right. They don't know when it was going to end. So why don't you send something? And I think, me personally, I don't think it was something nefarious. I mean, I don't think they wanted us all to die or whatever.
Sure.
As some of those conspiracies are out there. I think that it was just, as we talked before we come on camera, you know, lack of leadership or lack of the ability to lead.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking at it from a politician standpoint and management. I mean, how do I, because, you know, Hillary knew that she was going to run for president in 2012.
Right.
You know, she knew she was going to run for president in 2016. So she's, half her decisions are based on how that's going to happen, how that affects, you know, her decisions are going to be made based on how that affects that.
Right.
And I think that's why we got in. I mean, this is just my personal opinion. I think that's why we got involved in Libya in the first place. It wasn't an Arab Spring. I mean, it was, but the thing that most people don't realize is Gaddafi was doing what we wanted him to do. You know, because the eastern part of Libya was never friendly to Gaddafi in the first place.
Right, they hated him.
Right, and it's a different tribe. And people who don't understand how the tribal nature of things in the Middle East, I mean, those that do understand it, kind of, it's easy to
most
understand.
Most people have
this.
An understanding of the Sunni Shiite thing, but yeah, I don't think they realize how many others there are.
Yeah, and it's, and the Sunni Shia is not really a tribe thing. That's a religion thing from Islam.
Right.
Then you have all the little minor tribes and, you know, who's trying to gain power. And one, Gaddafi's been in power, so he's been basically subjugating the others. And they had this chance. And, well, what happened is there was a ton of militias training foreign fighters to go fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And basically, Gaddafi was told, if you allow that to happen in your country, you're next. I mean, what happened to Saddam Hussein can happen to you, and you lose your country.
Yeah.
Well, he started going attacking them. Well, Gaddafi being Gaddafi did it in, you know, the exuberant way he does things, and basically was going to annihilate him because he had permission to.
Right.
In a sense, at least in his mind, he did.
Sure.
And that's what started that conflict. Well, politicians figured, hey, don't let any crisis go unexploited.
Always.
So how do you make that? If Hillary Clinton goes in and sets up a coalition to combat Gaddafi, because he's the bad guy now, because we've changed administrations.
Right.
Then she can come out of that saying, look at my foreign policy. I did as good as Bush because I put together, you know, all these allies to come in and overthrow Gaddafi.
Right.
Well,
which destabilized the whole thing.
Right. And Benghazi was a result of that destabilization. So I think decisions were made because the ebb and flow of the battle, the ebb and flow of how it affects a career, were all the things that come into play. And unfortunately, that's what happens when you have politicians who want to make the decisions instead of listen to the people on the ground.
Yeah. It's kind of terrifying how people get into Washington and they turn into these, just these glazed shells of human beings to where they don't value life of others, like, at all. It feels like, I mean, that's all I could think of the whole time with Hillary Clinton when she was going to the Benghazi thing. And, you know, obviously the liberals are going to disagree with this. So I was like, this lady doesn't care about human life whatsoever. So no wonder people get in these crazy conspiracies where, like, they're not people, because right. They're not people. Even though they are biologically people, that is not a person.
Well, and
they don't care about anybody.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes back to that whole, the founding fathers didn't expect people to become career politicians. They wanted people who were leaders in their community to come to Washington, make a difference, and then go back and do their thing after a couple terms.
Yep.
No one would have ever thought when they found that. I mean, the one thing they didn't foresee was people that, hey, I want to go in there and stay as a politician. You know, why in the heck would you want to do that? Well, because it's about getting rich and money and power.
Yep.
You know, that's what, I mean, you look at,
that's what all of human history, the downfall of every great civilization or great people is always, you know, coveting money and power. It's just, yeah. It's just humans just do the same things over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And we always think that, you know what, we can make it better than it, you know, yeah, it was screwed up. I mean, you look at socialism or Taoism or Marxism, communism. Well, that's because you hear people on the left now. Well, yeah, that's, you know, it may be a little bit socialist, but we can do better than what what Russia did or any of the other groups out there.
Yeah, you've got kids walking around on the college campus not too far down that thinks that Karl Marx figured out the key to utopia.
Right.
They're walking around. Kids like people, even people who are in their mid to late 20s, you know, Ty's probably got some people that he's bumped into and didn't know who think that the Communist Manifesto is the blueprint to utopia.
Well, you look at all the people that run around with Che Guevara shirts. They have no idea who Che Guevara is.
They don't even know who he is.
Or what he did.
Yeah, there's nothing that upsets me more than somebody wearing, a Che Guevara shirt.
Yeah.
Although I do see some intelligent people who are walking around wearing it, but it's actually a chimpanzee wearing the same hat.
Yeah.
You ever see that one? Yeah, that one I do appreciate. Like, okay, there's a person who actually has some semblance of understanding walking around.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's got to be really strange for you, which kind of transitions us to our next point here, which is everything that happened after.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, as somebody who literally laid down their life, more times than one, but I mean, this is the key one, right? This is the one that kind of brought notoriety to you, your compatriots for what you guys did, which was, I mean, you guys repelled a lot of militiamen and put down dozens of them between a small company. And that's movie shit. Because usually that's not how gunfights go, right? I mean, that's not normally how it is. It's not usually lone gunmen. You know, life's not and firefights aren't a Clint Eastwood movie, right? Or even any war movie, right? Where you see the one guy just doing that thing. That's not how it goes.
Yeah, it's not a Western.
Yeah. But in this case, it kind of was.
It really kind of was. I mean, like I said, we were blessed so many times that the Lord is got involved for whatever reason that he wanted. I mean, I should have died at least three times that night. I mean, the mortars themselves are 81 millimeter mortars,
right?
Which have a kill radius of 132 feet, which means
and you were on a 30 by 40 roof.
Yeah. I was within 15 to 17 feet of three of them.
Yeah.
There's no reason. I mean, and the blast went through me and killed Ty on my left.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no reason I should be here.
That's got to create some weird, sense of purpose for you every day, right?
It does, and it kind of is why I do what I do now.
Yeah.
You know, and because of that, I've started a nonprofit called Shadow Warriors Project. We help private security contractors and their families when they get killed or injured. And it's even expanded further than that to now I received a service dog, and now we provide service dogs for veterans in need. And then we're starting another program up that we started this year down in Lubbock. And it's a canine therapy program where we bring in between 8 and 12 combat vets, pair them with a dog. We use the dogs to teach them how to manage stress. I'm not a touchy-feely kind of teach you how to deal with what we've been through. I mean,
you give off the let's hug vibe.
Yeah. I kind of do. I mean, at least no, but,
no, sir.
It's kind of, it's that tough love thing. I mean, and so we use the dogs cause the dogs are a direct, I mean, the dogs get stressed if I'm stressed.
Right.
And I can see how I'm acting in the dog. And if I don't calm down, the dog don't calm down. And so there's a course that we've developed that we put them through. And I mean, you end up three or four guys in a box that's 3 foot by 4 foot by 3 foot with three dogs. And you have a small hole to got to crawl into, and you got a small hole you got to crawl in and you're out of, and you're going over each other and different things like that. And if you don't maintain your composure, your dogs aren't going to maintain theirs. And when it comes to PTS, I don't think, there's not a cure because it's life experiences.
I like how you drop the disorder part of it.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of disrespectful, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's not a disorder. Yeah. It's another muscle that got injured.
Yeah, it's a cause and effect situation.
Right.
Yeah.
And those experiences that we've had are who make us what we are. It's how we react to that and how we respond to those, that pressure or that stress when we get it, you know? And so that's what we use the dogs for, to teach them how to manage that and put them in environments where they have to learn how to do that. We introduce them to the Lord, because I don't think you're going to ever get through PTS or manage it if you don't have him in your life. And then the third thing that's part of it is, you have to tell your story. And one of the things that's been great for me is having to tell my story. You know, I've told it 1,000 times or more, but it's cathartic every time. And right. I think that, and it's not just your combat story that you have to tell your whole story, your life story. 'Cause so many of us that are in the military, especially some of those units, we're either running from something or to something, and that's, or both, you know, we had crappy childhoods or single parents or, you know, whatever, child abuse or whatever. So you're showing up with a bucket half full of garbage already, and then you add in what we do in the military, and that fills it up. And if you don't let that, if you don't empty it, you're really not gonna, you're gonna, that it's gonna come out one way or the other. Right. You either control how it comes out. And it's a whole lot, it's kind of like peer-to-peer counseling. It's getting 8 to 10 guys together that all have been in some crappy situations and letting them talk it through.
Yeah.
And it's been really beneficial. We've had a lot of help, kind of talking with Texas Tech now. They may be doing a research project on it starting this fall.
On the dog portion specifically?
Yeah. No, on all three.
Really?
On the whole thing, yeah. Which kind of surprised me too, but it's Texas Tech. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, so a lot of universities have done a lot of stuff with, I mean, they're trying psychedelics and all these different things to try to combat PTS.
Right.
I'm never going to call it PTSD again. So yeah. Thank you for that. That makes a lot of sense. And it seems like way more respectful to say that it's PTS, but it is amazing that how many resources outside of the government are trying to help and how little actually inside the government.
Well, if you go to the VA website, you can see, and I'm going to piss somebody off saying this, but I don't mind. I have a way of doing that. But they have basically, there's 5 drugs you can take that they recommend. And then they have a couple different ways for counseling. And then outside of the traditional drugs and counseling, yoga and meditation. Those are your choices, and that's it. I mean, you know, and anybody that, I mean, growing up, you know, if I had a problem growing up, guess where I was at? I was out on my horse.
Yep.
You know, animals in general, and anybody that's listening to this who's been in our world, in, you know, the livestock world of some sort, you know, there's that connection, whether it's our cow dogs, our hunting dogs,
absolutely,
our service dogs, our horses, whatever it is. I mean, there's a connection that you have with them, and with dogs in particular. I mean, you think about it, dogs are the only animal that will leave their own kind to come be with us.
Yeah.
I don't believe that dogs are descendants of the wolf, because I've never seen a wolf leave its pack to come be with us, not unless they're forced to.
Yeah.
You know, they don't do that. And
have you ever been around someone who has like one of those
hybrid
wolves?
Yeah.
They're always cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're very different from a dog.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and again, you know, that's the thing we do. We were our last course, you know, a guy was telling his story and Roan jumped up on the table to sit beside him and just put her head on his lap.
Yeah.
And you could see her doing that, put a change in him. That was phenomenal.
Yeah. How long have you had her?
I've had her for about 2 years now.
And how old was she when you got her?
A year old.
A year old?
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did it take you to get bonded to her? Because, I mean, they're there to do that, but
it doesn't take much. And a lot of it's the way that we do that. So when when we're given a service vet, a combat vet, a dog, a service dog, we don't take it to their house and do it. We bring them out and take the dog out of an unknown place where it stayed and is comfortable, take the combat vet from a known place where they're comfortable, put them both in an unknown place. And the only two things that they have are each other. So it's a natural way for them to bond that much quicker. And, it works great. You know, we just see the guys, you just see them meld together, and that dog knows that that's it. And then they just continue to do that, and it grows. And the challenge sometimes is we got to remind guys that they are dogs.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, because, you know, a lot of guys, I mean, it becomes their child again, or that one thing that comforts them.
Right.
And, that's one of the challenges that we'll face in 10 years, 12 years when a lot of the dogs, when they lose them.
Yeah.
So that's another thing we have to prepare for eventually.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to lose a dog for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't last.
They don't. And, the bigger ones last a little bit longer than the smaller ones, but how many dogs have you went through growing up?
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah. I've had the same one since I was 19, and now, I'm 29, and it's pushing it. So yeah. You've got to mentally prepare for what that's like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So horses last longer than dogs, but the effects that, like, if you lose a horse is really difficult too, and that mm-hmm. really resonates with a lot of people, like dogs. But you get more time with horses, and they're not necessarily, it's not the same as a dog though. They're a little,
it's
a little different, but yeah. Still, like, in the rodeo world, I mean, the horses are what put food on your table. So it's very, very emotional.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
It's the other way around with the dog size. Bigger dogs tend to live less than smaller dogs.
Okay. That's what, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Ty.
Oh, I was just making
coming
sure.
here and
dime me out on freaking podcast.
Yeah, he did.
I just want to make sure you guys were right. I don't want you guys saying wrong information to other people. I want you guys to be informed.
That's true, because if you say the wrong thing, you get absolutely roasted. Somebody's going to come there, but you said this, but it's actually this.
Yeah, I know. I get roasted anyway, so if you want to roast me, go ahead.
I'm trying to help y'all out.
If you do, make sure you follow me. Yeah. And
exactly. Yeah, like, give me a thumbs up before you do that. They'd roast me all you want.
Yeah.
Any publicity is good publicity, is what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At least they're thinking about you, I guess. Guys, let me remind you how much we love Pendleton whiskey and how much you'll love it too. Here's the thing with Pendleton. It's not on every single shelf in the entire country. Sometimes you go to those small towns where the small rodeos are and you can't find Pendleton. That's where drizzly.com comes into play. Satisfy your inner cowboy by purchasing your bottle of Pendleton whiskey online. Buy it online at drizzly.com. Put it in the trailer. Pendleton blended Canadian whiskey, 40% alcohol by volume, Pendleton Distilleries, Lawrenceburg, Indiana. And please drink responsibly. All right, so let's go back.
Yep.
So we get through all that. You heal. How long was it from when you guys finished all this that it was time to write the book? I mean, obviously there were things that happened, all the press and things of that nature, I'm sure, but.
So I started talking with Ricky Schroeder probably in December of 2012.
So it was real quick after.
Yeah. But he was really pushing he wanted to grab it up like anybody. I mean, and I don't hold anything against him for that. He was sure. Just wanting to do what he does, tell the story.
Yeah.
And he's a good conservative. I mean,
right.
You know, he is one of the good Hollywood actors.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot more of them, but they just that you can't make it known.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
You just can't work.
Yeah, then we just need to start like here in Texas somewhere a conservative Hollywood.
They're trying. I mean, it's the like Ben Shapiro and that Daily Wire group. They're working on it.
Yeah.
But yeah. it's like a 50, 60 years too late.
Well, it is, but yeah. I mean, you know, late and it never. Costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, Hollywood controls a lot, but I think in the future, I think it'll change.
I feel like a lot of things are changing because people are just sick of the same old narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, I mean, right now, we have a country that is divided based on fear and hate.
Yeah.
You know, you can teach somebody to fear something, and if you can teach them to be afraid of it, then you can teach them to hate it. And it doesn't matter whether it makes sense or not. I mean, you talk to somebody who hates Donald Trump, and, you know, you talk to them and say, hey, are you paying more for gas? Yeah. Are you paying more in taxes? Yeah. Is your life easier or better now or better then? Well, it doesn't matter. He was just root, you know.
It's yeah, that you can't break tribalism though. It's
no.
it's just like the guys in Libya. Like yep. It's that same the same thing happens here. It's just we understand the language and the reason.
Yeah.
But it's
But it's the same on the other way. Like, even let's say Joe Biden did all these great things for everybody. You're bleeding red people. They're never going to accept him either. I mean, it's both sides.
Right. It's just, right. Yeah. It's, I mean, we're all guilty of it. I mean, everybody is to some degree. And that's that reason for fear and hate, which is, you know, really, I mean, because what we are here, I think, in America right now, or the world is facing a spiritual war. It's spiritual warfare more than anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we are facing evil that wants to destroy good.
You know what's funny, and not to get too woo-woo crazy or like into all that too much, but I've talked to more people who are going through more dark crap right now than ever. And I was having a conversation with my folks you met them at that deal, and that's how this whole thing kind of came about. And, you know, they're not overly religious. My mom's not overly religious, but she's getting more so just because a lot of revelation stuff going on right now. It's interesting. It's real interesting to delve into that. And everybody's going through what you just said, some type of spiritual attack right now. And like, without getting too mystical and all that, I mean, we are living in a strange time, Mark.
Well, you know, and somebody asked me early on when we were getting ready to write the book, they said, "Were you afraid of dying?" And I'm like, "Why would I be afraid of dying?" They're like, "Well, you'd be dead." I'm like, one of two things was going to happen that night. I was either going to live and get to go home and be with my family, which is awesome, or I was going to die and go home and be with the Lord, which is awesome. So it doesn't.
So I mean, you were pretty spiritual back when this was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I look at it like, yes, I mean, because pre-Benghazi, I mean, I've always had a relationship with the Lord. I was raised in the Methodist church. I sang in a church choir, joined the Marine Corps, and, you know, the straight and narrow's here. I kind of bounced across it like most of us do when we're young. And, you know, I think that how the older I got, the more direct I got with it. But then Benghazi was really one of those things. You know, I always, before Benghazi, I kind of lived, my relationship with the Lord was probably more of a, I'm going to try to do it where it works for me. You know,
the typical selfish Christianity thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead of just doing it for him. And I figure, you know, you kept me around for a reason. And I'm not going to take a second, you know, if I want to be around for my kids and my grandkids and all of that. So if I don't do what he wants, I may not be.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's pretty transparent.
Yeah. You know, so, and I mean, and I'm not, I think, you know, when you get into the whole thing of Christianity, I'm not a, you know, the turn the other cheek or whatever. It's like, yeah, I'll forgive, I'll forget, but I might punch you in the face too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I look at Christ and he was a badass.
Yeah.
I mean, look at all he went through and what he did. He was a badass. He was a special operator.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
You know, he wasn't afraid to overthrow he wasn't afraid to get in people's faces as well. You know, if they're screwing up, and you know, we've let the left define what a male Christian should be, and it's been
just a male in general. I mean, yeah. Look what's happening in the military.
Oh yeah.
That does very terrifying when we're talking about changing the standards of what, you know, our military operatives should be. I mean, you've seen it in police forces forever too, but to take it to the military, like, be what you want to be, man. You want to fold things up and change your gender, more power to you.
Whatever. I feel.
But don't tell me that we now need to take 3 miles down to half a mile, and, you know, you can do push-ups with a band on you, or pull-ups with a band on you, and like all of a sudden you're going to go out there and you're going to protect us in a situation you were in. No, you're not. You can get freaking murdered.
Right.
I don't want you to get murdered.
Yeah. I can guarantee you one thing, that the Chinese military and the Russian military are training every day to annihilate this country in one way or another. That's what their job is, to protect their country.
Yeah.
And if they think we're the enemy, that's what they're going to do. And then I think our military should be the same way.
It always has been historically.
Our mission is to protect this country against enemies, foreign and domestic. If what we're doing isn't benefiting that mission and the ability to do that, then we shouldn't have it. I mean, and I'm like you. You know, what you do and how you live your life is between you and God. If you don't believe in God, it's between you and God. You just don't know it.
Yeah.
But you'll find that one out someday, I suppose. I'm not going to judge you for that. That's up to you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I mean, it's kind of like somebody, when I was from the airport heading to the hotel, the guy that drove me there was an Iranian Muslim. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said, "Are you a Christian?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Well, how do you feel about Islam?" I'm like, "I've had Muslims try to kill me and I've had Muslims save my life." I mean, I don't condemn you for your beliefs.
Yeah.
These are just mine and that's how it is. And, you know, you have to live your life. I don't.
Yeah.
I've got my own to worry about.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to respond to those things too.
I mean,
what a bold Uber driver though.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Well, it was kind of cool. We got to talk in Farsi a little bit.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Cause I speak Farsi as a second language.
Yeah.
He
probably got a lot out of that.
He was surprised.
Yeah.
Cause there's not a lot of people, especially a lot of white guys that walk around speaking Farsi.
Yeah. Not a lot of blonde hair, blue eyed guys walking around doing that. He probably realized he wasn't carting, and well, if the dog didn't give it away.
Yeah.
It's like, you're not a conspicuous man walking around, Mark.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, probably by design.
But, yep.
So you guys wrote the book, and mm-hmm. then was it 2 years after the book or so when they wanted to do the movie, or how long was it after that?
Well, the movie process, the book process actually was a lot longer than what it had to be because we submitted it to get reviewed.
Right.
And they would come back and, well, we don't like that or this or, you know, and so we had to take things out and do things different. And then that was, I think 2014 is when the book came out, and it was 2016, I think, when the movie came out, early 16.
Yeah. It was a couple of years after the book, I thought. Yeah.
I actually had the premiere in Dallas here.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the... Cowboy Stadium.
Yep.
Largest. This is what cracks me up about the whole thing. This is how bad they didn't want to know about it.
Yeah.
The largest premiere, Google it, it's the largest premiere ever in the United States. We had 40,000 people that showed up.
Yeah.
There's never been another premiere that's had 40,000 people, but no one ever really reported on that.
Yeah.
I mean, it never really got its just due.
Yeah. How, were you guys a part of the movie production very much?
We were. You know, we were apart from the, I mean, they wanted us because we had to endorse consult. It. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we, one of us was on set probably, I think they filmed for 70 days. One of us was probably on set for about 40 days. Sure. Not all of us at one time, but all of us were there at some point.
Yeah.
And Michael Bay wanted to get it right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's some things that were different and he did take some liberties for the purpose of entertainment, but
which you have to do, I suppose.
Because it's not a documentary.
Yeah.
And his goal is to keep people's butts in the seats till the end and build that anticipation to what's going to come and tell the story. And from my standpoint, I can't speak for the other guys. I mean, they kept to the spirit of what happened.
Yeah.
And that's what was most important.
Was it hard to watch the movie? Were you able to sit and watch that movie as just a viewer of a movie, or were you stuck in your mindset and your experiences, and were you critical of everything? Ah, that's not how it went. I mean, how were you able to internalize that film?
I've watched it complete, I think, 3 times.
Okay.
Once I saw bits and pieces as Michael was putting it together, and then he had a premiere basically for the families, mm-hmm. all of us and Ty's family, Glenn's family, all of that were involved. And we went out to Paramount Studios and watched it there. And that was the first time I saw the whole thing. And then I was at the premiere in Dallas, but I was up moving a lot. I didn't watch the whole thing, but, and then, so that was the closest I've watched the whole thing. And then the third time was, did a fundraiser for our nonprofit in New Hampshire, where we had a sponsor that rented a movie theater, and it was one of those movie theaters that has, they serve food and alcohol
at
high top tables kind of thing.
And it was kind of one right down the road.
Yeah. About 200 people. And just raising money. And that was the part of the thing was they get to watch the movie with me. So, which they all got to enjoy that and then get to ask questions afterwards.
Photos,
and
things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the 3 times, but I mean, I look at it for what it is. I think I just compartmentalize it that way. It's a movie. But you know, there's some hard parts in it.
Yeah.
Obviously.
I would assume there would have to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so,
but not the book. I mean, the book is true to form. I mean, the book's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. The writer that we hired to do that was part of this. I mean, he was phenomenal about how he was able to put all our different pieces together.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
I mean, because you got six people basically telling stories.
With erratic thoughts and a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and he didn't want us to talk about what each other was telling him because he didn't want it influenced. Right. He wanted the raw material from what, I mean, go out and tell us what you remember.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody had a different amount, obviously. Just some like to talk more than others.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it was good. They did a phenomenal job.
Yeah. I mean, dude, the whole process, I mean, even though it's a Hollywood drama movie, I mean, it's still, I mean, there was a reason that they were so, meaning, you know, the political landscape was so distraught with it because it still served its purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and this is the thing, you know, it's as leaders, I mean, as a leader, you take responsibility for, as I put it, you can delegate your authority, but you can't delegate your responsibility.
Yeah.
I can tell people who work for me to do stuff, but ultimately if they do it or don't is my responsibility, because if they don't do it how I want it or the way it should be done, I either failed to lead them or I failed to train them. And, you know, with politicians, they're always trying to point the fingers at somebody else. It's not me, it's them. It's, you know, and, I'm not really happy with very many politicians at all.
No, it's near impossible to be. It's very rare that you find one that you can even stomach, frankly. I mean, you hate it. You hate to say that.
It's true.
It's the truth.
It's true. I mean, get in there, do your, you know. I mean, I think we should have term limits. I mean, yeah. Senators don't need to be there more than maybe 18 years, 16 years, you know, yeah. Two, maybe three terms at best.
Yeah.
You know, because you want some seniority, at least they understand some things. But, I mean, and if you did it right, there would be always somebody there that knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't get so entrenched that they think they're the ones running the country.
No. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Some of the power that some of these, you know, congressmen and senators have just based on a lot of that seniority is pretty troubling.
Yeah, you look at who gets to decide on who does what. I mean, so the whole thing is like high school. When you show up as a freshman, you know, if you want to get accepted on the football team, you better be, you know, kissing butt to somebody or be just have some stellar attribute, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Until you get these AOC characters who come in and then all of a sudden they're running the party, but...
Well, I think they're just running their mouths.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, and there's some on there.
Not well.
No. I mean, you know, if nothing else, I think we've all learned over the last 4 years of election cycles from the midterms of Trump all the way through coming up in the midterms that, you know, the right to vote is a big responsibility.
It is.
You know, and we can't...
But not big enough where you need to have an ID to do it.
Yeah. But dang, I got to get on. I got to have one to get on the airplane, though.
For whatever reason, or buy a beer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, or cigarettes or
yeah.
Drive a car, or, but not vote. Huh.
Well.
Because people don't know how to get their driver's license or get an ID.
Mm-hmm.
So they say.
In certain communities. So they say.
Yeah. But when you talk to anyone from the communities, they know how to do it.
Yeah.
They're smart. They're intelligent.
They are.
You know.
And then they find out that their own party said that about them, but they still don't change the voting. That's the only thing that blows my mind. But
well, it goes back to that fear and hate.
It does.
Because I got somebody, if I can get you to fear something and hate it, then I can get you to do whatever I want. I mean, that's how we overthrow countries.
Yeah, historically.
Yeah.
It's never, I don't think that part of it will ever change.
No. Nope.
I kind of want to ask you just a couple things and then we'll let you get on with your evening. But as far as the PTS goes, when did that take effect for you? Was it before Benghazi from your other tours and other experiences with, I mean, obviously maybe the things with the children, or was it not something that was real prevalent to you, or you noticed it in yourself until after that? And then you wanted to be proactive with helping others.
You know, and I think it affects everybody differently. Cause one of the first things people asked me, you know, and I know I have remnants of PTS. I tried not to, you know, I didn't really want to admit that for a while. Roan is my service dog's really helped with a lot with that.
Sure. The admitting part of it, or?
Yeah. Well, and it actually happened. We were doing a canine demo with the Navy SEAL Museum up in New Hampshire at an event called SWAM. It was Swim with a Mission is what it is. And they were raising money, and they asked me, I was just up there to be part of the demo. And they said, hey, would you mind, because they have a dog program as well, this Navy SEAL Museum. And they said, would you get on stage and kind of tell what the dogs do for you? And I'm like, you know, Roan, because one of the things Roan does for me is she's also a protection dog.
Right.
And that's why she does bite work. So, because, I mean, there's obviously people out there that don't like me.
Right.
And wish me harm. So that's what she kind of covers.
She's have you had some encounters with people?
Yeah, off and on. And then I've had some death threats from people overseas because they think I had something to do with the death of their family members.
Sure.
You know, their sons or daughters or something like that, whatever. You know, probably not in a while, but that's one of the reasons. I mean, I travel a lot. I'm a, you know, pretty public figure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's why. So I never thought of her as PTS or helping me with that. But I got up on stage and I was trying to tell them, and I got this thing. I tap my chest and she'll stand on her back legs and kind of put her, I'll have my arm here and she'll wrap her paws around my arm and put her head into my chest. Mm-hmm. And when I did that for that, it just kind of clicked. What she does for me.
Sure.
And that's what kind of got me into wanting to do service dogs for other veterans and doing this canine therapy program is, you know, I know what the dogs do for us. And, you know, cause somebody asked me, and again, kind of getting back to that, is they said, you know, do you have nightmares? I'll bet you have nightmares, huh? I'm like, no, I don't have nightmares. I don't have a problem sleeping from that. I have a problem sleeping because I got TBI, a traumatic brain injury.
Right.
Which, you know, has a lot of the same symptoms as PTS as well.
Sure.
You know, I have things like that, but I don't have bad dreams. I don't have it, you know, sometimes my stress levels, I always wonder if it's because I'm getting older. I'm just tired. I just don't have the patience for stupid shit anymore.
Right.
You know, but that could be a little bit of PTS as well.
Sure.
But, you know, it's learning to manage it and learning to deal with the stressors that come on in life.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Keeping yourself from that.
Yeah. It's a lesson. Cause I think anybody who's been through anything traumatic, not even just military stuff, you have to find a way to get out of it.
Well, you do. I mean, it's, you know, and, I mean, whether it's a car crash, and everybody, you know, and the one thing I've seen with a lot of the people, I mean, from my law enforcement career, my military career, my contracting career, and now my career is, you know, doing what I do with nonprofit, is I've seen a wide variety of people that have PTS. There's no one cookie cutter thing that caused it. You know, I think that it's amount of trauma that you have, and little trauma as kids builds, you know, your bucket starts to fill up.
Yeah, so I mean, that's what it is. And eventually, some people may have a cup. Some people may have a 10-gallon bucket. Eventually, it's going to overflow if you keep putting stuff into it.
And if you don't get rid of it, you got to talk about it. You got to get it out. I mean, if you don't want to talk to, the one thing I always hear is, I don't want to talk to a counselor. They don't understand. Well, of course they don't understand. I don't understand what you went through because I didn't go through it. Well, but you went through something, so you understand that. And I'm like, don't use that as an excuse to not go talk to somebody.
Right.
Because that's why we have 22 people killing themselves, 22 veterans killing themselves every day, because they don't think somebody understands.
Right.
Well, you don't need somebody to understand. You just need to tell somebody your story.
You just need somebody to listen to you.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, and that, I don't, if it's a rape victim, if a kid that was raised in child abuse, you know, go talk about it, get it out, is the best thing I think you can do.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. That's, it's kind of a theme that we've had with quite a few of our guests. We've had some people who've been through some pretty interesting things, and that's always, you know, don't be too tough. Don't be this. You've got to talk to somebody. Human brain's only capable of so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Hard exterior can't protect. You've got two sides to your brain, and the one that holds that stuff only operates one way. Doesn't matter how much of a hard ass you are.
Yeah, and, you know, and I can keep it from coming out for a while, and then it'll come out in little bits, and then when it does come out, it affects my family, my kids, my relationships, my friendships, because you become a crotchety old shit, and no one wants to be around you.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And then you're alone, and then you have isolation, and then you blame, you know, you victimize yourself. And we as a country don't help much. I mean, we try to victimize everybody.
Yep.
I mean, you know, hey, if you had this, we're going to, you know, this is how you should feel. Why do you get to dictate how I feel?
Yeah.
You know, and that was one of the big things with me. I'm not going to have, I choose not to have bad dreams. You know, I don't have them. But I go into it understanding that people are going to die. People are going to live. And I mean, there's the circle of life. People live, people die. That's like, I kind of look at it like riding roughstock. It ain't if, it's when.
Yeah.
If you work in the military fighting bad guys, it's not if you're going to get injured or see a friend get killed. It's when.
Right.
So if you go into it with the right understanding and you're mentally that's part of it, you better, I mean, accept it for what it is. Don't be a victim because, you know, my friend got killed. I mean, I've had a lot of friends get killed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I really hope they have a relationship with the Lord. If they didn't, I hope they got one real quick, and I hope they're kicking it in heaven.
Right.
You know, because we're going to see each other again. I mean, and that's where I think why the Lord has to be in your life as well.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that's a great place to end it, because that's probably the most important message with any amount of the topic, I think.
Yeah, yeah, so I agree.
I'm with you. Well, Mark, that was pretty stellar, and I'm really thankful that you came here and that you took the time to fly out and stay in the hotels and do all the things to be a part of the show.
I appreciate it.
I can't wait to actually listen back, so it's going to be really good for me to listen back to it, but appreciate you.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Absolutely. Good time.
This has been The Gauge, hosted by me, Chance Conrado, produced and edited by our guy, Ty Yeager. Shout out to the executive producers, Dustin Pointer and Cody Denton. Marketing and content produced by Riley Chone. Make sure to rate and review this podcast, as well as follow The Gauge on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And make sure to subscribe to The Gauge wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you guys next time.